copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
It's really good to meet you here, and I hope we will have a good discussion. I hope you will listen very critical towards what I'm saying, and we can have a good discussion. I mean critical not in the sense of being negative, which is one way of being critical. I mean critical in the more classical sense of analyzing and probing and testing and inquiring into. And then we can have a good discussion and help each other. I like this picture. The people don't know their true power. We have a fantastic, a unique privilege of living in open and free societies, which is a unique thing historically, to have open, free societies with a democratic system that actually includes everyone. There have been some smaller versions of it, but if you think of the democracies in antiquity in Greece, it did not include everyone, and everyone was not treated equal. So that was only for the free men, the free Greek men who had an influence. Now, it is a unique period in history that we have in Europe, free, open society, where we can all make a difference in how our culture, how our societies are developing and what will happen. It is a unique situation. And I think that we as Christians should take that very seriously. We should not withdraw from society when we are given this fantastic opportunity. Of course, people that have very opposite convictions than we, they are making use of this possibility. And we shouldn't complain that they are making use of their freedom. We should make good use of our freedom. And I think too many Christians in Sweden, for example, are complaining with what a number of other groups in society are doing with this freedom, instead of thinking long and hard and deep, how can we contribute into our society? What is our role within this freedom and openness? How can our voice be there in a positive, creative, provocative way? So I think we have a lot of things to do here. For reasons I will mention later on, I've been studying several biographies of William Wilberforce lately. And that can be recommended. It's a fantastic story, what God did in this man's life and then through his life. So I recommend. There's several really good biographies. I think some of them are even sold at the book table. I have no commission for saying this, but so it's really from my heart. So Eric Metaxas, Amazing Grace. And there is also the leading politician from Britain, William Hague. He has written a biography of William Wilberforce. In Metaxas' biography, Amazing Grace, he retells at one place a story when Wilberforce starts to oppose slavery and starts this decade-long or several decade-long campaign against human slavery. He's, of course, opposed from all sides. And at one point, this happens. Metaxas writes, "In the thick of the battle for abolition, one of its many dedicated opponents, Lord Melbourne, was outraged that Wilberforce dared inflict his Christian values about slavery and human equality on British society. And Lord Melbourne said, "Things have come to a pretty pass," he famously thundered, "when one should permit one's religion to invade public life." It was a bit of a surprise for me to read this, that it's obviously, it has a long history, this kind of separation between politics and religious convictions. And Lord Melbourne is complaining that Wilberforce is backing up his fight against slavery with his Christian convictions, that everyone is created equal by God and is created in God's image, and therefore this is morally wrong with slavery. And Wilberforce's opponents here try to force him out from the public square, saying, sure, it's okay for you privately to hold on to those beliefs, but don't drag them into the public conversations. And we have this kind of attitude still with us. And I think we need to do what Wilberforce did, not to be silenced, not to withdraw, but to claim our right to be in the public square and make our voice heard, together with other voices, of course. For us as Christians, of course, our attitude towards society and the public square must be grounded in the New Testament. So even though I'm sure many of you are familiar with the material, just let's remind ourselves of what we find in the New Testament. There's many passages in the New Testament that implies that the Christian should be involved in society. When Paul writes in Romans 13 that the authority is God's servant, of course it can. The conclusion cannot be drawn, we should withdraw, we should never engage. If the state is put there by God and serves God, or is called to serve God, of course not every individual state or every individual person is serving God, but the institution as such, if it's put there by God as a servant of God, of course a Christian can be involved. We can see that both Paul and Peter have the same attitude, that we submit under the authority of government. We don't withdraw, and we are not revolutionaries that try to overthrow with violence, but we submit to the authority and work within the structure to make it better. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, we have a well-known encouragement from Paul to pray, and I would like to read that. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. I urge you then, first of all, that requests, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness. This is good and pleases God our Savior, who wants all men to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth. So a strong encouragement that we should be involved in prayer and intercession for all those in authorities. Now think of it. The things we are praying for is always a calling for us to also be practically involved within. Think of it. You cannot pray for something without being open for you yourself being part of the answer. So you hear that someone is lonely, and you pray to God, God, please, see to this person's loneliness. Give that person some friends. And then you cannot say, but I will never, ever visit that person. I will withdraw from that person and continue to pray for friends for that person. It does not work that way. If you start to pray for it, your heart will be more soft, and immediately a thought will come up in your mind. Maybe I have a possibility to visit a person. You cannot pray for a person who is poor and pray, Lord, send someone to help that person, without reflecting, should I be the one to go? And of course, if we pray for those in authorities, that they are going to lead society so we can live godly lives and so there is peace in society, of course the thought will come up, will I be one of those persons who is leading society? You cannot exclude that. So I think that we are called to pray for it, there is an implicit question for us. Is that our calling? Maybe it's not our calling. We have, God can have other callings for us, but we cannot exclude it or say no Christian should go into that. I find it interesting that reading the letters in the New Testament, and there's a lot of greetings, and usually we focus on the heavy doctrinal passages, and we focus on the ethical instructions and the passages on sanctification, and then we skip over, often in the end of the letters, there are a lot of greetings from people and greetings to people and so on. But they are interesting to read because it says something about the first Christians. I don't know if you've noticed this, that in Philippians chapter 4, Paul speaks of those Christians who's working in Caesar's household. So they become disciples of Christ and they continue to play a part in Caesar's household. We have no details. But obviously they are not called to, you must immediately leave that sector of life because now you are Christians. Or in Romans, it talks about Erastus, the city's director of public works. So he's a high official in the big influential city of Corinth, and he's become a Christian, and he's called to continue to serve the city. In Acts 17... we have the names of a few people who came to faith after Paul's famous sermon. The woman Damaris, don't know much about her. And then Dionysius, who was a member of the Areopagus, of the council. So he was a leading intellectual within Athens. And there is nothing saying that he left that role after becoming a Christian. Or a person I recently discovered, I've never noticed, in the letter of Titus. So if you go to Titus 3, verse 13, the letter to Titus, Paul has some greetings and some instructions to different individuals. And he says, do everything you can to help Sennas, the lawyer. So, here is a lawyer, has become a Christian. And Titus is going to help Sennas. And then he mentions Apollo, which presumably is the Apollos we know from the book of Acts, who was from Alexandria, and who was a learned man. And of course, we don't have the details, but a good guess is that he had access to the world-famous library in Alexandria, and that he actually was an academic, since he was so well-learned. So here you have a lawyer, you have an academic, and Paul takes a good care of them, and they are important. And there are no signs of Paul thinking they should leave their roles. And of course we know that as Christians, we are called to be involved, but not only to continue with what is going on, but we as Christians and the Christian church should be a prophetic voice. We should be salt and light. We should make a difference So, we are on really firm biblical grounds when we say a Christian should be engaged in society. We should find our different roles and places also on the public square. We should take part of what's happening in our society. We should make a positive contribution, and we should be prophetic voices within our society. When we engage in the public square, and we are arguing in the public square, what should be our goal? I think it's very helpful, the three models that Os Guinness has been written about. And we had the privilege of having Os Guinness here last year, for example, so maybe some of you have heard him speak about this. And if you have not read the Global Charter of Conscience, I really recommend it. It's free on the internet. You can download it. It's a very good text on how to think of an open, free society and of the Christian's role in that society. Os Guinness, he makes a difference or a distinction between three different ways of thinking of society and the goal for our work in society. The first, which is the most common historically, is to think of a sacred public square. And with that, Os Guinness means that you have one religion or one worldview, one set of ideas that is dominating. And historically, that has been a religious ideas. So, for example, my own country, Christianity has been the totally dominating system of ideas for 400 years. Until the year 2000, we had a state church. So the public square has been sacred. One religion was dominating and was the default position, and others was forced out towards the corner or was not given a place at all. And of course, globally, many, many societies are structured that way. The second model is to strive for a naked public square. And that is when people realize this is unfair. We don't hold on to the same religious beliefs. Why should one religious belief then be the default position? No, people then say, we should have a naked public square. It should be neutral. No religion should be the default position. No worldview, no set of ideas. And that is the direction which most countries in Europe are moving towards now. It's very much so in Sweden that people want to establish a naked public square. The only problem here is, of course, that neutrality is a myth and no one is neutral. And in reality, it is a secular perspective that is given the privilege of being the default position, the assumed position. And now all the religions are out in the corner, or people are saying, you can be religious in your home or in your churches, but don't bring this out here. What we should strive for, says Os Guinness, is a civil public square. That means that the state as such do not take a stand on which religion or worldview is true. But then everyone meets on the public square to debate and discuss. Everyone is free to bring their own ideas into a civil conversation. And the questions are not solved by violence. The questions are not solved by forcing some people leaving the square, saying you are forbidden to be here. No, everyone is welcomed, and we try to solve the discussion with debates, with dialogues. We're trying to distinguish between good and bad ideas, between true ideas and false ideas, between constructive ideas and negative ideas. The civil public square. And I think this is very important for us to see. I meet a number of Christians who think that we should strive to re-establish the state church, or Christianity should be the default position. Look at our long Christian history and so on. But I think that's the wrong thinking. We cannot go that way. What we need to fight for is a civil public square and keep it open for everyone. Because if it's open for everyone, it's open for us. So we can be there, so we can be open with our convictions, so we can be open with the gospel. If it's not open for everyone, of course, in the long run, someone else will dominate the square and we will be the excluded one. So we need to work for the civil public square. Okay, that's a little bit about my background thinking. Now, a number of lessons from Sweden, and it will differ a little bit from your outline. I want to be a little bit more practical, and I've been asked to describe some of the things that we have been doing in Sweden and make some comments about it. Not in order for anyone to copy that, but to hopefully be inspired to think, what can we do in our situation? And I think I will give you 7 points, so 7 holy points here. Firstly, we have been working, and when I'm saying we, I'm thinking mainly within the Evangelical Alliance. We have been working hard of getting people out of the bunker. There are many Christians in Sweden, not as many as we would like to, we were many more 50 or 100 years ago, but still we are many Christians. But people are hiding within the churches. So secular Swedes don't know about the Christians. We need to go out from the churches. Of course, we need to gather in the churches. But we need to come out of the bunker to be at places where normal Swedes are and start to take part of the public conversations, to go to debates, to be involved in dialogue and discussions, to show that we are part of Swedish culture, Swedish society. We are here. Get used to it. We are here. And this is how we want. This is our thinking. These are our convictions. This is how we live. This is our contribution. This is our challenge. And we need to try to find places where we naturally can come into contact with people. It so happens that we have a unique institution in Sweden called Almedalsveckan. Almedalen is a beautiful park on a beautiful island out in the sea between Sweden and Finland. It's a medieval city, beautiful. And for some strange reasons, politicians have started to go there to give their summer speech. And that has grown out to a gigantic event with all politicians in Sweden. All mainstream media is there, all lobbyists. So everyone, and it is actually everyone who wants to take part in the kind of public discussion about things related to Sweden, they are there for 1 week out on that island. For many years, there were nearly no Christians. So that's been one thing we have been working. We need to have good Christian thinkers there, taking part in the dialogue, the conversations, and also start to present how do Christians think about all those issues that are discussed there constantly. You think, here's a lot of seminars at ELF. During that week, there is between 1,500 and 2,000 seminars during 1 week. So it's a massive event. But everyone is there. You go there, and you will come close to the Prime Minister. You will see him a number of times during that week. And in Sweden, the security things are not that big, so you can actually approach him and say hello and introduce yourself. So it's a unique event. We need to look for those kinds of places. Of course, I know a lot of countries do not have Almedalsveckan. But there are meeting points in all cultures where you naturally can come into contact with people. Secondly, we have been working with public debates, and we found that very helpful. So we have done it in Sweden. We are doing it in Norway. And by the way, people sometimes get the wrong impression since I make sometimes jokes about Norway. But in reality, I'm very closely related to Norway. As you heard from Margot, I'm working 20% in Norway. My three children, all of them, will be for the whole summer in Norway working, because you make more money in Norway. My brother, who is here, actually lives in Norway. So, you know, I'm surrounded by Norway on all sides. Okay, public debates. That has been very fruitful in Sweden, that we have arranged public debates between Christians and atheists, mainly Christians and humanist associations. And it draws a lot of people, and it creates a lot of debates and dialogues. It helps the Christians to see that the Christian faith actually managed to stand up in a dialogue with the non-Christians. So it encouraged people to live open with their faith. And it has given us so many contacts within the non-Christian world, because non-Christians are coming, and now the non-Christians are starting to arrange debates and are inviting us to come to their events. Actually, one of the best events I've done for in the past couple of years was that the humanists in Stockholm, they invited me to give a lecture on the theme, the Christian critique of the new atheists. So they wanted me to present my critique or our critique of their heroes on their ground. Well, that's very interesting. I did not publish that event because I did not want a lot of Christians to come to destroy it. Because then there would be a fight in the audience. So there were just 2-3 Christians, because we need some support in terms of prayer and so on. But huge groups of atheists. And of course, they never heard this kind of critique. And in the Q&A, that was the best Q&A I've had in a long time. Because they started to ask questions about the Christian faith. So, public debates. Very interesting to work with. Fascinating. And it is a way to show that here is a serious position that most people, at least in my country, have said no to, but not really realizing what they have said no to. Thirdly, when we move out in the public arena, we need to have a wide perspective to work with many, many different issues. Of course, I love to talk about God and about Jesus Christ and to present the gospel. And of course, we should do that. But I think we need to be open and curious people who are ready to address any kind of issues. And to show that we care about human beings, that we care about society, that we care about culture. We have recently done some things about modern slavery and thinking of trafficking. And we can see that a number of Christians are taking initiative to try to help the girls that are trapped, enslaved within that business, and a number of non-Christians. And here are many areas where we can work together We have tried to work in many different areas to address questions that are relevant for us, of course, but that are relevant for the whole of society. Of course, we have worked with issues that many Christians naturally feels called to work with in terms of right to life, pro-life issues, which is very important issues. We have worked with the marriage question. A number of years ago, we had a big the big discussion on same-sex marriage. Unfortunately, we lost it, so we now have same-sex marriage. So we have been involved in those kinds of discussions. But we have also done quite a lot of work in the areas of religious freedom, freedom of speech. We have been involved in work for tax deduction when you give money to organizations. In Sweden, we had none originally. We were the only country in Europe, as far as, or in Western Europe, that did not have any tax deduction at all for giving, because the state wants to take control of everything. Now, together with many, many other forces, we managed to introduce for the first time a tax deduction for gifts. It's pathetically low and so on, but it's the first step, which I think will be an important thing for the whole society. We have been working in terms of the educational system. So I think it's important for us to have a broad perspective. Fourthly, we need to accept that we are living in a pluralistic society. This is the consequence of thinking in terms of a civil public square, is that we accept pluralism as a sociological fact. We are people with different convictions living together. That is not the same as accepting every position as true or right, but we accept the sociological fact that we are people with different convictions and we need to find ways of living together. Here it will be very important to make distinctions between legal issues and moral issues. Of course, they are connected, so everything legal should be moral, but not everything moral should be codified in a law. And that's a huge difference, and we need to think clearly here. In Sweden, we decriminalized homosexual relationships in 1944, so that's a long time ago. I never for one second have opposed the freedom for people to live whatever way they want sexually. As long as they don't, you know, you need to have some limit. You are not allowed to hurt someone, and you need to have some age limits. But I've never opposed that. I do not want the control society with surveillance cameras in everyone's house to see that everyone is doing the right thing sexually. But when it comes to same-sex marriage, I led the campaign against that, because that is another issue. What should society, or how should society define marriage? Now, every society do have a definition of marriage. You cannot call everything marriage, so you need to have a definition. And there are good definitions, and there are bad definitions of marriage. And that is really a relevant question to discuss. What is a good definition of marriage? And then you need to discuss what is a marriage and what is the function of marriage. And in my view, also for a secular state, there are many good reasons to keep the traditional definition of marriage as a one man, one woman relationship. Because that relationship is a unique relationship. It's the only fruitful relationship, biologically, that exists. And the whole future of society is dependent on that relationship, not on the same-sex relationship. That relationship is, as such, totally irrelevant for the future of society. But the man-female relationship is absolutely crucial for the future of society. Therefore, society has good reasons to say we want a special institution for this special relation. And added to that is that this special relation results in children, and children need to be protected. And children have the right to be connected to their biological origin as far as that is possible. And marriage has traditionally been viewed as the best way to secure for children that they have the chance to be related to their biological origin. And that is actually a human right for a child to, as long as it is possible, we all know that the parent can die and so on, but as long as it is possible, a child should have the right to be related to its origin. And marriage is the way the society secures, as far as it can, that right. Okay, so that was some of the arguments. And we need to distinguish those arguments from which kind of sexual action should be legally allowed. That's another issue. So here we need to think clearly, how should we argue, and how should we, what causes should we fight in a pluralistic society? Fifthly, when we are on the public square, we need to base our arguments from natural revelation. Now, don't misunderstand me. If we have a civic public square, everyone is allowed to come there with their religious ideas. And I have the absolute freedom and right to quote from the Bible and say, I believe this way because the Bible says so and so. And we should not be afraid of it. And I'm happy to quote the Bible. But we need also to acknowledge it has no argumentative power for my audience. I have the right to quote it, and maybe I should do it to show this is part of my belief system. But it's, as an argument, it has no power whatsoever for my secular friends. So if I want them to start to think about the issue, I need actually to put down the Bible and say, here are some arguments for why I'm thinking the way I do. Later on I can show, by the way, the Bible is moving in the same direction, but I know you don't care about that book, so I'm not bringing that in so much in the discussion. So here are the arguments. Like I argued a few minutes ago against same-sex marriage. I did not refer to the Bible. I did not mention God. I just had a discussion out from reality, some basic facts. And here I think we need to educate ourselves in all areas. How can we argue out from natural revelation, out from common grounds, when we are in the public square? Why am I opposed to abortion? Of course, I can quote a number of verses in the Bible that clearly speaks of the uniqueness of every individual from the womb in our mother's lives. So, of course, there are strong, good biblical arguments. But in the public square, that's not where I start. I would say I have two arguments. Why I'm against abortion. The first one is the principle that we all agree on, everyone in society, that every individual has dignity. Every individual has worth. Every individual should be treated with respect. Think of the declaration, UN's Declaration of Human Rights. That's my starting point. And we all agree on that, so I think I can move on. I don't need to argue for that. Every individual has dignity, should be treated with respect. Secondly, my second argument, or second premise for drawing the conclusion that abortion is wrong, is biological facts. When does the human life start? what is the starting point for human life, biologically? Now, I'm a theologian, so ask some biologist. And everyone have to acknowledge it starts at conception. That's when human life starts. So now I have a biological fact. Life starts at conception. I have an ethical principle that everyone seems to agree upon. A human life should be treated with dignity and respect. Conclusion? It's deeply problematic to destroy a human life. Of course, from conception, there is a lot of developments and changes which continues after birth. You take a newborn baby and a one-year-old and a nine-year-old and a 20... It's not the same if you think of identical functions and how it looks. And there's been a lot of... It's developments all the way. So I'm not denying that, but that does not affect the principle that everything that is human, everyone who is a human, should be treated with dignity and respect. After conception, that is a member of the Homo sapiens, biologically. It has the DNA of a Homo sapiens. You can do whatever test you want on it. It comes down to this is human life. So if we want to uphold the principle every human individual should be treated with dignity and respect, then we need to say this is deeply problematic. Okay, so a long argument for, but we need to do this in every area to develop arguments from natural revelation. And then, of course, we need also to show how this fits together with special revelation, with the Word of God. Sixthly, and I will hurry on so we have some time for discussion. We need to search for unexpected company, and not only write together with Christians and act together with Christians, but do the surprising thing. So, for example, do things together with the humanists. We do not disagree on every point. We are equally opposed to trafficking. We're equally opposed to the Sharia laws of Islam and on many other issues. Why don't join hands with those who are our opponents on some issues, but that we actually agree with on others, to see that we are not against specific people, or we are not thinking this kind of group thinking. We would actually like to make a difference on specific issues in society. We should not be afraid of other people. And we can join hands with them as long as we are moving in the same direction in this area. And at last, we should use humor. It always works. To give two examples. One example was when the gay lobby in Sweden, they were opposing that a person was given a certain job because the person had the wrong view on same-sex relationships. So they say the person cannot have that job. Now, simultaneously, their own organization was searching for a communicator, someone working with their information. And so what I then did was that I publicly applied for that job to see how they will treat me. And since I was well known as opposing same-sex marriage. Now, of course, they would like to protect their organization from a person with my views, in the same way we want to protect, for example, a church from a person with their view on homosexual relationships. Now, so that was a very good way for us to make a point that we try to use their method on themselves. And I think we can win quite a lot if we find those ways of doing it. Just before we went here, we had what is called the Jesus Manifestation in Stockholm. And it's between 10 and 20,000 people gathering in central Stockholm. It's like a Jesus March. Now, we've noticed for many years when the Pride Festival is in Stockholm, all the local buses have the Pride flag, the rainbow flag on the buses, on the city's buses, to celebrate that now is the Pride Festival in Stockholm. So now we wrote an official letter to the city and saying, we want you to put flags on all the buses in Stockholm to celebrate that we have the Jesus Festival. And we noticed that your argument for putting flags on the buses when it's a Pride Festival is that it is a way for you to signal that an oppressed group, homosexuals, are welcome to this city. But as we all know, Christians are the most oppressed group globally of all groups. And we have many refugees coming to Stockholm from countries where it's really dangerous to be a Christian. And we think it would be very important for the city to say to every Christian, you're welcome in Sweden to be a Christian. And of course we sent this letter and of course simultaneously we sent press releases to get this covered by the press. Now we received a letter back and they were saying, no, it was not able for us to have flags on the Jesus Festival because our festival did not have the same dignity as the Pride Festival. Now, of course, then we could use that to go back. Okay, is the oppression of Christians of lesser dignity than oppression of homosexuals? What's your thinking here? Are you making a distinction between different people? Now, we don't know what will happen. We never thought that we would have flags on the buses, but we hope that we will be able to force the city not to flag the Pride Festival. And I think the only reasonable thing for a city in a pluralistic society is to not flag any event, acknowledging the fact that we do disagree on deep and important questions and issues, and the city does not take a stand on those issues. It's not pro or against homosexual relationships. It's not pro or against Jesus, the city. It must be a city that is welcoming people with those different convictions. And then on the public square, we need to have a discussion about this. The discussion should not be solved by flags on the buses, because that is the signal when you have the Pride flags, isn't it? That their way of looking at life is a right way at looking at life. And I don't think it is. I think it's the wrong way. So in this case, the city has taken a stand on an issue that a city in a pluralistic society should not take a stand, but it should leave it to us as citizens to debate. And then, of course, in the end, every individual, we have to take our own stand. Okay, so this has been a way of trying to use a kind of humor and using our opponents' reasoning for our sake. And I think that we can gain quite a lot if we find those ways. Okay, sorry for speaking, talking too long, but now finally the holy number 7 was here, so we have finished. Thank you. We often are asked the question, were you raped and pregnant as a result? Or have you experienced the struggle of same-sex attraction yourself? And it ends the discussion. My response to that would be to say, firstly, I'm aware that it's a huge personal suffering involved in those issues, and I have not experienced that suffering. But do you really mean that I can never have a moral opinion of something that is not afflicted me personally? I have never been murdered or murdered anyone. Am I allowed to have an opinion on is it right or wrong to to murder? I'm not starving. Can I say something about how to treat poor people who are starving? This seems to be a way of silencing a discussion. And I would ask back, have you never had a moral opinion on something that you personally have not experienced? In Sweden at the moment, we have a huge discussion about immigration. Most of those people involved in immigration, in the discussion of immigration, are not immigrants themselves. They are Swedes. Of course, we can have an ethical opinion, and I think Sweden should be an open country and receive refugees and immigrants. I think we need to acknowledge that there's a lot of suffering involved, but I can still have an opinion even without being afflicted myself. Of course, it makes a difference if I can add that I do not only have a theoretical knowledge about the affliction, I actually am a good friend with several people that are struggling with same-sex attraction. We talk a lot about how to handle life when you are struggling with this. So I know it not personally, but I know it from close friends. So I'm not distant from the situation. And then if we stay with the discussion on abortion, I think we should point out, because that's a standard reaction, but what about those who are raped? I think we should point out, okay, so you think if someone is raped, then abortion is okay. Okay, let's go with that. We are in agreement to 95%. And you are together with me in a fight against our current abortion laws. Because they are not saying you can have an abortion if you are raped. We have free abortion. So if you mean what you say, that abortion should be allowed after rape, then you're really on my side to a very, very large degree. Then we have this special issue. But come and join me in my fight against free abortion, because that is the issue. The right to abort your child for whatever reason. That's how all the abortion laws looks like in Europe. In Sweden, you have free abortion until week 18. It has nothing to do with rape. It's free abortion for whatever reason. So people are fooling us with taking one specific case and think that motivates the whole law. In Sweden, that would be the law from the 1930s, then you could have abortion after rape, but nothing else. Now, the discussion now is the abortion law from 1975, free abortion until week 18. And then, of course, you have to discuss this special case then. But we need to show people that they are not really fair in the reasoning here. It's a fake argument. It's emotionally very powerful. But in reality, as an ethical argument against, you know, it's a fake argument. So the question is, in a culture like Norway, and it's the same in Sweden, people have blocked out a number of issues. It's not... they are already decided for them by the culture. How to deal with that? That is a big issue. It's like no one discusses or thinks about is Santa Claus for real? Because we know, everyone, Santa Claus is not real. Is Christianity true? No, everyone knows it's not really true. You have this kind of cultural atmosphere where the culture has already decided to a large degree to put a certain issue out of the picture, into the shadows. And that is very difficult to break through that. And we need to be creative and find as many ways as we can. If I take the situation in Sweden, I would say the debates tour we have had with William Lane Craig, for example, have been very successful. So here is a leading academic, a leading philosopher. Now, Swedes have academics and philosophers in high regard. Now, that's an eye-opener. He's actually arguing for the existence of God. So for some people, that is really important. Other people will, of course, be much more impressed by what the church is doing downtown Stockholm amongst the prostitutes. So there is one church that everyone in Sweden, I would say, have heard of because of what they're doing about amongst the drug addicts and the prostitutes. And it's really a marvelous work among people that no one cares for otherwise. And that has opened the eyes for some people. So there is not just one method. We need to work on many different levels to try to bring back the issues that our culture have tried to silence. I think we will have good help of the immigrants coming from other culture who just take God for granted, both Christians from Africa and Latin America and Muslims who take God for granted. Even though we differ in so many other areas, and that's an area we agree with the Muslims, that God is there, He is our creator, we are responsible before Him, and we empty life totally if we ignore God. Maybe a last question? Yeah? So the question is, in secular Sweden, if Christians, priests, pastors are invited to media shows? No, it's not very often. There are a few that are invited, like our former archbishop. He was often in the media. He was very clever, or is a Lutheran archbishop. Unfortunately, extremely liberal, denying most elements of the faith. But he should have a lot of cred for being extremely good with media. Unfortunately, using it then badly in terms of what did he say when he had the platform. We have two journalists that are very publicly Christians, or one journalist and one writer, I should say, that have made a really good impact. One is an older man in his 60s. The other is a younger man in his around 40s, I would guess. But they have been really clever in being high level in their what they do as journalists and as a writer and as a poet and so on, and being admired for their gifting. But they've also been very clear in communicating their faith and in challenging people to start to think. So it's not all dark. There are some really good lights also in the media world. But generally, the media is so focused on entertainment and distraction. So most shows is shallow in terms of what are the subjects of conversation. It's not the bigger issues of human life, human relationships, meaning, identity. It's much more on the surface, unfortunately. There was a lot of things in relationship to the same-sex marriage debate, because that's so touchy. And we had a small campaign on the subway in Stockholm, a small posters. It just said, mom, dad, child, and then keep marriage. People were so angry about that. And I was invited to newspapers, radio, television, and we were on the front page for the next day, everywhere. So this was not an evil or provocative, if you've seen it, it's just harmless. But it really touched the nerve. So there we really managed to get the attention we wanted. And we're giving a chance to discuss it. Of course, people were really angry. And there was one article who talked about three small evil men. And those three small evil men were Hitler, the Pope, and myself. So it was an odd company. And so you need to have some hard skin, I can tell you, if you in that kind of issues are being public. That was the second biggest daily newspaper in Sweden, so it's a serious paper, but they still allowed a text comparing Hitler and the Pope. And then adding me to the mix.
Thanks again, Stefan.
Thank you.